Welcome to The Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, our guest is Eric Ronning, EVP and Chief Revenue Officer for Digital at AdLarge Media, which is the fastest growing premium advertising sales representation organization in the U.S., which represents radio, digital, and mobile content providers. Prior to joining AdLarge, Eric was the EVP of Emerging Media at TargetSpot and the founder and managing partner of Ronning Lipset Radio. He is here today to talk about the future of streaming and targeted advertising in cars. Here is my co-host, Courtney Harding, starting the interview with Eric Ronning.
So Eric, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
Excellent. So the first question I wanted to sort of get started with is, why have cars been so slow to adopt this technology? We're looking at a sort of state of play now where huge numbers of people have smartphones and iPods, and car companies are just now starting to put the connection wires in as a standard. And I know this isn't a new problem because I bought a car in 2002 and it still had a cassette deck. And it was a new car in 2002. So I understand that this is something that cars are generally pretty far behind, but it's getting to the point where it's almost farcical. So, you know, I wanted to sort of see what your take on this was. Like, why are they so slow to adopt a technology?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a common thought, right? You look at the lag time between the technology and something as important to the American public as a car, and why they don't match up, right? But I think what we have to do is think about the reality of the time frame. Like a purchase cycle for a car is typically 7 to 10 years. And that lifetime compared to, the time it takes to turn over a cell phone being 16 to 18 months, right? So imagine if Apple put out a phone every 7 to 8 years, and that was the fastest they could upgrade their technology, because that's the time it took you to buy a new one. That alone, I think, slows down or makes the perception that it's not happening as fast. But on the other hand, you have to know behind the scenes that those people are working on it diligently. They're thinking about it. And to their credit, they have to think about how to put it together in a way so that when the new car is released, they've not only caught up with what has been happening over the X years, but they're as far ahead of the future as they can get, because it has to last another 7 to 10.
Right. So, I mean, so are we starting to see cars coming out now where the technology is in place to just plug in your phone? I'll be completely transparent here. I'm a New Yorker and I don't actually own a car. And I haven't purchased a car since 2002. So, you know, where are the cars right now? Like, if I was going to buy a new car off the lot tomorrow, what sort of technology would I be looking at?
So most of the new cars now have got some kind of digital dashboard that includes the capacity for music or radio, and it's either a auxiliary jack that you can plug into directly, or more commonly now, a Bluetooth connection. And in more cases, and beginning to roll out over the next 4 or 5 years, you're seeing the in-dash unit, which is controlled completely by the car, some of which have their own wireless systems.
Interesting. So I guess the next question I wanted to ask was, looking at, and again, I'm not in cars that often, but I do rent them from time to time to go out of town. And I've noticed that when I rent newer cars, I get satellite radio and Pandora in dash. And that seems very common, that a lot of cars will come with, this is like Sirius XM, you get a free year. It's all sort of baked in. So how are they able to really break into the car market when other services haven't been able to?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And if you think about the two companies, they're very different in the way that they've made their way into the car. Starting with Sirius, you know, they really, at the end of the day, they started the model years ago. And really what they started doing was, they pay a lot of money to the OEMs, or to the original equipment manufacturers, the car companies. They pay money to the partners to put the radio equipment into the car. And, you know, when they started, it was very low. I think they're up to approximately, I don't know, I think it's around 60% of cars have, you know, the new cars coming off or cars in the last X years have had that system put in, whether or not people sign up for it. is another thing. But, you know, the numbers state that about half of the people who have access to it end up converting to a self-pay subscribership. So they started the model, if you think about that first move, where the radio in your car was always just a feature that had to be in there. And it was just expected, and there was no real upcharge for it, and, you know, everybody used it in the same way. And the people who made money on it were largely the radio stations selling advertising. And Sirius comes along and creates this new model to disrupt that and says to the manufacturers, hey, look, we will pay you to be part of that. Change out the units. Put in our units. Don't get rid of the AM/FM, but just put ours in as well so that people have access to it. And to incentivize you, we will work with you financially on that process. So that's been a very effective way. They started early enough that their infiltration, and then that's benefited by the fact that there's this turnover rate of 7 to 10 years, right? So they have a lag time before they're completely removed from the cars, if they were ever to be so. And Pandora is in for, I think, a different kind of reason. They came along at a time of change where people were thinking about online radio. They had proved a model to some degree. They had name brand recognition that, you know, it was hard to talk to anybody at the car side or the engineering side or the agency side that was doing advertising. Most people at that point knew what Pandora was and had a favorable view of its future. And, you know, that's really a lot of how they got their traction. They've got that brand recognition. They certainly have money. And they've devoted that to, I think their team is up to over 30 people right now that are focused just on in-car systems and those relationships. There's a whole company that just does that. So in the same way that SiriusXM paid or, you know, created a financial relationship to get in, I think you could say Pandora's done a similar thing in that they've put a lot of money into that relationship and really taken it very seriously.
The interesting thing about both of those two companies, though, is that they're both in Dash. And I feel like, and again, you know, I have to caveat a lot of this by saying, like, I don't drive that often. But for me, I just have everything on my phone. And I feel like it's actually, even if I have that stuff in Dash, I don't ever really use it because everything lives on my phone. So are we starting to see a trend where the in-Dash stuff is just going to go away because so many people just have everything on their smartphones?
Well, I think it's almost, there's a school of thought that looks at that in the opposite, that the in-Dash is just starting to take hold, and that the bring your smartphone and tether it through either a cord or through Bluetooth is becoming more established, but is not guaranteed to go the distance, right? I'm not sure how that works out, but if you think about some, there's some figures out there that can guide you a little bit. In 2009, as an example, the percent of Americans who owned a smartphone was about 10%, and the most recent data showing 2013 that was up to 53, so that's about 150 million.
Yeah.
But of that demographically, right, if you think about that 53% in 2013, 75% of that number was 18 to 24, and 75% of 25, 34-year-olds had their own smartphone, compared to 34% of 55 to 64-year-olds. So that's a prime set of, you know, people to reach and to think about. And then if you look at some of the actual usage patterns that have been documented, the number one thing people are doing on their smartphones is obviously making phone calls, right? It's like 97%, you know, or more. And then down the line to number, I don't know, 10 is listening to online radio is the 10th thing that they choose to do, right?
Hmm.
But if you break that again further into those numbers are ever, if you break that into heavy use or daily, the number one thing that smartphone users is about 91% are making phone calls, and about 18% are listening to online radio on a daily basis, right? So there's clearly a lot of room for that medium, if you will, of a smartphone to grow or to be used in that way, and I think that that's happening. I think the 2014 data is going to come out soon, and I'm pretty confident you're going to see an uptick in that. But it is indicative that, you know, it's not a done deal.
Yeah, and just to sort of dig into the demographics a little bit more, because I thought that was interesting. You know, I grew up driving, and I grew up having a radio on the dash, or putting CDs in the dash, or cassettes on the dash. So I'm a little bit more used to interacting with a dash, whereas if you look at a kid who's getting their driver's license right now, they might like be just so used to interacting with their phone, with their device, that interacting with a dash seems very sort of odd to them. So I'm wondering if we'll see a shift as the younger kids sort of age up and as people who are used to having in-dash interactions get older. Do you think that's possibility, or is it just too far out?
I think that's a really cool insight. And, you know, that group of that age demographic that you're talking about that's getting their licenses now or recently, you know, that is, I don't know, even 5 years ago. I mean, those people, they grew up watching videos in the backseat and playing games with headphones on, right? And forget listening to online radio or using the dashboard for anything. They weren't even listening to music for the most part.
Yeah. Right?
They were getting their music elsewhere. That was coming from, you know, digital sources and, you know, other places. It wasn't really associated with the car in that same way, I don't think. So the insight there is intriguing. I don't know the answer, right? And I think that's the excitement of the future of this business. That's what everybody's kind of rallying around, is what could be. What is now is certainly not what we're going to end up with. I think everybody agrees to that.
Well, one sort of frightening, to me anyway, glimpse of the future that I got, I was in Japan last year, and my husband had a friend from college who was living over there, and we met up with him to go have dinner, and we get in his car, and he's got a TV in the dash. and he said he's very good about it. He only will like put on, you know, their version of CNN, and he'll just sort of listen to it like it's NPR when he drives. But he did say there's a lot of people that are driving and watching TV in Japan at the same time. And I thought that was truly, truly scary. And I hope that trend doesn't start over here. But I guess a lot of these millennials and younger kids that are so used to having the in-car entertainment, hopefully they don't push it up to the front seat. So we've talked about all this. What has the impact been on terrestrial radio? I mean, it's obviously been really seismic. But what changes are they making to try to survive a little bit longer in this climate?
I think terrestrial radio stations or traditional radio broadcast groups are certainly healthy. And they've been working very hard in the last 10 years, I think, even more so. You can see a lot of activity in the last 5 where they really seem to take it seriously and think about, okay, what do we do here? How do we take what we've earned and go further? And, you know, there's some variable things. I think content is going to be the key deciding factor for a lot of these choices. I think it's going to be experiential. And, you know, terrestrial has some really good experience in programming and how to put those things together. So that's not a lost scenario at all. They're experimenting with multi-channels. So the programming directors of these radio stations are creating pure online radio stations that they're, you know, visions of their own passion, the music that they would, you know, put together if they didn't have to be constrained by lowest common denominator on a radio signal. And those things are available through digital and HD radio or also streaming, you know. So there's things of that nature. But generally speaking, what seems to be happening is the radio side of the house, or those with experience in traditional radio, seem to be favoring the concept of live and local. I think the meaning behind that has been largely talent, the sound and voice, the feel of the radio station, the information that you gather, the locality of that being a... you know, to quote the old kind of thinking, the friend that's in your car. I think that they're trying to figure out how to take that advantage and go the next step. The difficulty for traditional radio has been, in many situations, the large ownership groups have kind of diminished their own value there, because they've gone to voice tracking and, you know, a national syndicated model where one DJ voice is in 20 cities and, you know, get some kind of overlay to make it feel like he's in that city or she's in that city. So they kind of have to think about that. It's unclear. There's certainly a large footprint. There's certainly a favored nation usage for the demographics. I think this younger group that's coming up and going forward will be very telling. The radio industry puts out a lot of data that says that younger audience is still using radio, and you know that their time with audio consumption has increased because of these other options. And those in the pure play market are favoring reports that say, you know, contrary to that, that they're not using as much traditional radio and they're seeking their information elsewhere. I tend to believe, you know, as usual, the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle of all that. And it's going to be up for grabs for the best experience is going to win. The best kind of marketing or presentation of who you are to the user, how you're connecting with the user, is what's going to be about. Pandora has won the early rounds in this because the word of mouth was excellent.
Yeah.
In the early days, it was the engineers passing it off to, you know, other people in the office, and then those people passed it to their friends, and those people passed it to their parents, and, you know, that's really hard to replicate that. I don't think that can be replicated again.
Yeah, and I think another big differentiator between terrestrial and streaming is that people have really different expectations when it comes to the number of ads they'll put up with. On the rare occasion that I do listen to commercial terrestrial radio, because I'm not in a car that often, I'm really shocked by how many ads there are. Like, I'm completely blown away by how much time is taken up by ads as opposed to streaming, where, I mean, I just pay $10 a month for Spotify and I'm like, hey, no ads, great. But if I'm listening to Pandora, for instance, which I don't pay for, it's a couple ads an hour, if that.
Right.
So how is this all going to play out? Is terrestrial going to have to cut back? Is streaming going to start playing more to make up for it? What's the future for this conflict?
Well, I don't think it's been resolved yet by any stretch, but I think it's fair to say that the concept of people accepting more ads on traditional than they would accept on pure play is not real. I don't think anybody will accept a large number of ads if they don't have to.
Right.
So, you know, that level of, hey, we've always been able to run 18 units an hour, so that's going to go on forever. I mean, that's not realistic by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
The difficulty, as a guy who started in radio, I mean, I've, you know, been in the audio business since it was 19 or 20, is this concept of spot load following the radio clock. Or the, you know, the timing, the programming clock of when you hit music, when you get, you know, news and information, when you get your commercial breaks. I think that's probably pretty outdated based on what you can do today, but it's hard to change that in the terrestrial space for a couple of reasons. One, the competitive set pretty much demands that as much as everybody who's a programmer or owner would love to run way less commercials and charge more for them, it's a very difficult move to make. And it's difficult because the people who pay the money for it don't want to pay more money. And the people who own or invest in the companies that are the radio holder groups don't want to make less money. And there's always a human element that, you know, you got to make the number. So even with the best intentions, if a radio station cuts back their station load and says, we're not going to take any more than 5 units an hour, we're going to charge 4 times as much because they're worth more now, it's very noble, and it usually lasts a little while, but the competitors, you know, find a way to get the business, and that company quite often will change its tune. Whereas terrestrial is kind of locked into that, so I think it's going to be hard for them to make a shift. Pure play, on the other hand, you know, they came out of the box with the expectation of no commercials. A lot of these music companies were built by people who were dissatisfied with the music that they could get in traditional radio, and they wanted a better answer. And that better answer to them was, I don't want any commercials. So there's a lot of zealotry at that level with these companies that were built with, you know, let's create music that is always accessible, no commercialization, it'll be great. And then the reality of, you know, they get investors and people want to make money.
Yeah, exactly. It's all fun and games until you have to pay your employees or pay the rights holders.
Yeah, so that reality sets in, and I think most of these companies have matured to the state that they clearly get it. Pandora is a good example. You know, when they started out, that was their story, and they very wisely and professionally moved to a model that seems to work for them, which is not that many impressions or not that many ads at a good price that's fair to both parties and still keeps a good user engagement going.
So I wanted to touch on another sort of key differentiator with ads on, you know, streaming versus ads on terrestrial, and that's the micro-targeting. So I know that for, you know, let's say you're a radio station in New York, obviously people buy ads for the New York market. Well, the New York market is massive. So if I'm in my car in Brooklyn and I hear an ad for something in the Bronx, I mean, that's irrelevant to me. But from everything that I've read, the trend now for the streaming services is the ability to micro-target and micro-target down to, like, pretty much your exact location. So if I'm in my car in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, I'm going to hear an ad for a business that is in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And I'm going to also hear an ad that is catered to the fact that I'm a woman in my 30s driving a Zipcar, a Prius, you know, all this different data that they can get from me. So, you know, I just love to hear sort of what that's going to look like in 5 or 10 years and how terrestrial is going to survive that.
It's an interesting problem. And I think if you look at and go back just a touch, and let's start with the traditional radio, right? So that's been typically between $16 billion and $20 billion a year have traded hands in advertising for terrestrial radio stations, which are transmitter and, you know, radio towers in a field that can project their frequency and their content about 60 miles in any direction, plus or minus, right? So locality was just not something you thought about. It was a given. Chicago station, it had to be in Chicago. New York station, it had to be in New York. Couldn't hear it in San Francisco, except for, you know, a couple of clear channel AMs. So that concept built that $16, $20 billion business, and it was largely based on large national brand advertisers who are everywhere and wanted to reach people through this medium, and medium to large local advertisers who were relatively ubiquitous, like a JNR or somebody like that, right, who are in many locations but specific to a city. And it didn't really help the small business, the one shop owners, or the people who were trying to grow. You really wasn't too practical to invest your money in traditional radio until you had a certain size. It was hard. The promise of the digital audio is this micro-targeting that you speak of, which is real. The technical capacity to do that exists. It is not, by any stretch of the imagination, as perfect as many of the owners or people with vested interest in that technology would have us believe, but it is certainly available and possible. Some of the difficulties are much of that information is based on multiple sources that are stitched together through either partnerships or simple access that, you know, you go scrape the info. And anytime you're cobbling stuff together like that, there's weakness in the chain and there's potential for mismatching, right? So the only way to really know that you're a woman in a Prius in Brooklyn is through a combination of some geolocation connectivity, right, that they're GPS tracking you, and that you are in the car because that information is somehow connected to the car, so it knows it's that car, and that has to be linked together somehow, and that you were a woman because either they've implied it by what you're listening to, which is a weak way to go, but it's the way that it's been done, or that there's some registration data for that car or that GPS device that's associated with you. So getting all that from one single source is really the sticky wicket, right? And there are multiple ways to share that information and cross that information over and assume things and capture it. And it's not there yet, right? So a company like Pandora has the greatest potential because they have as close to a closed loop system for listenership and relationship with each user as you can get. You register, you give them information about you, you listen, you repeat, and you can be tracked by, you know, if it's your cell phone you're listening to or whatever it is, they have some good idea of where you are physically. Conversely, for ad networks or people who are putting together multiple partners, that's a much more difficult task because, you know, if you're not Pandora and maybe Clear Channel iHeartRadio, it's very difficult to get your user group to offer up registration data. Certainly difficult to get realistic registration data. That is one of the fascinating things about Pandora. If you ask them and you know, talk to people there, they'll share with you. I think a lot of their registration data is considered to be as pure as it can get in the online space. People don't lie about who they are when they sign up for Pandora.
Yeah, that's true. That wouldn't have crossed my mind, or Spotify for that matter. Like I feel like those services, I feel like I signed up using Facebook for both those services and it just made it very, very easy. And I feel like, yeah, that's pretty accurate data that you're going to get.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Whereas you as a person who just said, right, I gave them accurate data, I'm sure you've signed up for things that you gave them no information of any value because you just wanted to get what you were getting and you didn't want to be.
Oh, yeah, I've registered as my dog for like many things, you know. I've given all sorts of fake information out, but not for streaming music, which is interesting.
Right. So that's the interesting thing about music and this relationship with audio, be it terrestrial or pure play. There's a real connection there that is, I think, something we don't fully understand on the advertising side, its importance. Right? You are connected to your music so deeply and so personally. If you look at Facebook, as you have mentioned, and you look at who you project as person, right? You have probably, like most people, embellished some part of that to, you know, shine up your personality or your presentation of self for the public.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Everyone does.
But you probably, as is in almost every case, did nothing at all except share exactly who you are musically in that same process. Right?
Yeah. I work in the music industry, so probably there's a few bands I list as bands that I like because they're cool, but I probably don't listen to them that often.
If they came on, you wouldn't turn them off.
Probably not. That's probably true. And I feel like, and I'm probably more of an outlier because I do have to, you know, because I work in the music industry. I feel like most normal people will just list stuff that they like and call it a day.
But if you can put together a way to say, okay, this musical taste or this musical direction is more indicative of who this person is in their heart and soul than what they've told me about, you know, what they like and long walks on the beach and who they work for and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
And that's a missed part of the growth here that I think is really going to catch on now that we're connected digitally, now that we're thinking about what we can glean or find or intuit or whatever you want to do through that. And I think that is really going to be the power of what this audio connection is in the future. I think that's everything.
Yeah. So I want to talk about more of the streaming stuff, but maybe not so related to advertising. And again, I have to keep caveating and saying it, like, I don't live in LA, so I'm not in my car all the time. But and actually Kyle, who co-hosts this, lives in LA but doesn't have a car. So he's really like the magic unicorn.
I'm from there.
When I do listen to the radio in the car, because I was trying to think like, okay, when do I listen to the radio in a car? And a lot of the time it's to hear the traffic report. And I don't think I'm the only one this applies to. I feel like I've read data where people listen, you know, they want to hear the weather on the ones or the traffic on the fives or the, you know, the top headlines of the day or whatever. And they're not really paying as much attention to the other stuff on the radio. They just, like, want to know, should I bring my umbrella or should I avoid taking this road versus that road? So, you know, that's one thing that streaming services can't offer right now. You can listen to Pandora and hear great music. You can't listen to Pandora and hear a traffic report. So I'm wondering if there's some way that integrates, like you can get Google traffic integrated into your Spotify stream. So every 5 songs, your Google traffic report will come on. And because you're, you know, in a connected car, it's not, again, like if I'm driving in Brooklyn, I really don't care that there's an accident in New Jersey. I care that the BQE has, you know, has problems or construction. And because I'm using Google Maps, you know, I've entered my destination. So if I'm driving from Brooklyn to Long Island, it's going to tell me if there's a problem on the Long Island Expressway. It's not going to bother me with like, oh, there's something in, you know, in New Jersey or in Connecticut that's troubling. So I'm just sort of wondering what that future looks like.
Well, so refer back to the conversation about terrestrial thinking about themselves as live and local, right? That's the advantage. That's what they've done. That's been part of the content. That's what, you know, they consider to be radio. That's part of the experience, right? And the news, the weather, the local information, the bands playing, the, you know, local gossip, the local politics, all of that are part of, quote unquote, the show. So I do believe that's a huge advantage for terrestrial currently. And I do see that the streaming services that you would consider pure plays have not necessarily woven that into their experience yet. I think a lot of that has been, you know, growth and learning from the pure play ownerships who, you know, if you remember that, I mean, these companies largely started as some really smart tech engineer people who put this stuff together out of love, and it just kind of grew. And it's only recently that traditional radio thinking has integrated itself into those models, right? That they've hired people from that other side, and they're starting to share information. So you gotta believe that they're aware of it. And technologically, it's, you know, it's not impossible to drop that kind of information that's self-selected into your programming. There was a guy at CBS, David Goodman, who I work with, and now he had an idea a while ago that was still relevant, which was this pick and choose format, which was you'd pick your format, you'd pick your DJ, you'd pick your news source, you'd pick your sports source, and you'd put it all together, and that would be self-serve to you as your own custom radio station top to bottom, right?
Huh.
So I don't think that's an unthought of concept. I think that that's out there in multiple areas, and people have thought about that and looked at it. And I think technologically it can be done. I think the will to do it is, you know, it's hard for people to make that leap.
Yeah. So I kind of want to now talk about sort of the post-ad world, if we can move beyond the way we currently think about advertising now, because, and you and I were on a panel together and this came up and I thought it was really interesting. Someone was talking about how millennials, and now whatever the generation after millennials is going to be called, they don't consume ads in the same way that people like you and I do. So we both grew up before DVRs and before being able to skip ads and being able to watch whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted on your iPad. And, you know, so I feel like I don't have a huge tolerance for sitting through ads, but I feel like my tolerance for sitting through ads is much more than a 20-year-old or 10-year-old's would be. So kids, you know, a 30-second ad for a product is like weird and old and disruptive, but they're totally fine with this, like, Chris Brown writing a song about Wrigley's gum and it becomes a hit. You know, these are kids that would never look at a billboard, but they'll follow the Denny's Tumblr. So, you know, how are advertisers going to deal with that, especially on streaming services and on terrestrial too? Like, you know, you're dealing with a post-ad generation. What do they do? What's the next step?
Well, I think this is the idea of native advertising, which, you know, is a bandied about phrase that I guess is important now. People are, you know, talking about that, and it's easy to understand, I think, what a native advertising would be in a print or a website kind of content, you know, integrated into the an editorial integrated into the content in a way that made it feel,
yeah,
you know, as part of the show. I don't
or
know
even on TV, you know,
yeah,
like
on TV,
I was
right?
watching House of Cards, and there was a scene in House of Cards. This doesn't give anything away, by the way, where they're in a Lowe's parking lot and you can see them meeting, and then there's a huge Lowe's sign behind them. And I'm like, yeah, that's how you do native advertising.
Yeah, right. So that's crazy. So great show, by the way. And that concept of placed advertising, you know, has been around for ages. I mean, there are firms in Los Angeles years ago that was their business, was, you know, creating those connections and getting product placement in movies, TV, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not a new thing, which is what cracks me up about this new concept of native advertising, right? It's exactly what's always kind of happened.
Yeah, but how do you do that in radio? That's like my big question is how do you, I mean, it's easy, not easy, but it's doable on TV, it's doable in print and on the web. How in the world do you do native advertising on radio?
It's really not clear yet. I think podcasting has some great promise for that because it acts the most like a show that you can integrate content into because it's spoken word that you're listening to, and it's the most natural way to do it. I think you can look back to Howard Stern, who is, you know, clearly, in my view, just the master of doing that. He was able to integrate his sponsors into his show in a way that was completely natural and made sense for who he was and who his audience is, right? And that's, you know, you can't get any more perfect than that. What the media is missing today is that kind of personality with that kind of power, or the willingness to use personalities in that way yet. I think we're getting there. I think you're going to start to find this balance that seems right. And I think using the Howard Stern example again, you know, it's, as far as I know, to a fault, every advertiser he took on was somebody he actually believed in and cared about. So, you know, it was coming from the heart in some way, shape, or form. He was connected to it. He found his piece of that made it real and made it natural. That's native, right? You can't just pay somebody to say stuff.
But how do you integrate that into music? I mean, that's great for Howard Stern, talk radio.
So I hope your Chris Brown example is not the long-term future, because that would make me sad as a person who likes music.
Yeah, but, me too.
Right, it's possible. I guess the changing idea of artists and what they represent and who they are, I mean, that, you know, that's altering. That associative value is huge. Artists are much more aware of the value that they have in that process, and there's many more people and businesses who are helping them extract that value for their brand. So, you know, I think that's going to continue, no question about it. But on the, you know, the more basic level for the local advertisers or the medium-sized advertisers that can actually, you know, not afford to do a deal with Beyonce or have her write a song for you, you know, how do you do that? And I can't help but go back to the associative value of the experience itself should be a really valuable thing, right? If you feel good about the music that you're listening to, or call it a station that you're listening to, or your selection of music that you have been involved in and feel personally associated with. And there's a proper alignment of an advertiser that makes sense for you in that, in a right way. And I don't think that's a 60-second ad or a 30-second ad that's terrestrial that's moved over online. I think it has to be crafted for the experience. I think that can be very successful. You know, I've had some experience with that with my business partner at the time, Andy Lipsett, and I, when we had Running Lipsett Radio. We did, you know, a lot of experimenting with clients to that nature and did custom ads for online that spoke to the fact that they knew people were listening online, and they resonated, right? That was very simple. We're not marketing geniuses, right? So somebody who really cares to dig into it and can do it well, I think it could be very powerful.
So, and just sort of to wrap it up, and again, looking at maybe the post-ad world, you know, people never had to pay for terrestrial radio, obviously. It was just something you turned on and could listen to, and that was part of what was great about it, was it was so accessible. But now people are being offered the chance to pay for the streaming services and not have to listen to the ads. And the price point is, I would say, for the most part, pretty compelling. It's, you know, $10 a month for Spotify, and it's pretty cheap for Pandora. You know, these are all great deals, and people are comfortable paying for Netflix, paying for Hulu. They kind of get this. Do you think this behavior will ever reach sort of a mass adoption where most people are just, you know, it's part of their cable bill or it's part of their just monthly expenses? And then what happens to the advertisers if that's the case, because they're kind of locked out? Do we, again, see this Chris Brown-esque future where pop songs are actually secretly about soda pop or chewing gum? Or, you know, what do the advertisers do? Do they, I mean, you saw the Netflix solution with House of Cards and all that product placement. What's the solution in radio?
I don't know that we know yet, right? I think historically, leading up to today, as much as, you know, the recent insights or data shows, you can see there's really been nobody who's been able to break a, I don't know, 5% of an audience, 10%, something of that nature. You just can't get much more than that to pay for music that's commercial free. So you see subscription models is certainly something that investors like because it's a annuity. You can count it up. You can tell how much and conversion rates. If I do this, I get this many people. I make this much money. But there's a limit to the number, the size of the audience you can garner that way. In almost every case, people who've started off as pure subscription model have somehow managed to find a free model as well to augment that. What will be interesting is to keep an eye on Beats with their partnership with AT&T,
yep.
Which is, you know, the first realistic possibility to have a bundled pricing structure that is, you know, easy to absorb in an easy to pay way. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there. And iTunes Radio, clearly, you know, they choose to go that direction more aggressively. They've obviously gone down that path a little bit, but you know, if they get into it further, that could be a tell. Spotify has a larger than average percent of subscription, I believe, but you know, as evidenced by the fact that they went to a ad-based model in mobile recently, you know, clearly wasn't enough. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I've got my eye on the Beats team. I got a lot of faith in those people. I think there's some really smart folks working over there. And you know, if the subscription model is going to succeed, that is probably a really good thing to look at for how it will work.
Cool. Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. I know that you've got a lot going on. If our listeners want to hear more of your thoughts or find you online, where can they find you?
I'm always here at AdLarge Media. It's my home and good people doing good work for the audio business, terrestrial, digital, and other.
Excellent. Are you on Twitter? Are you Tumblr? Anything?
Get me right at Eric, E-R-I-C, at AdLarge.com.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you again so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the time. Kyle, thanks, and I look forward to speaking with you guys. And Courtney, we'll see you out there.
Yes. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Take care.
That's
take care.
All Bye. For this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thank you to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. And if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you for listening.